is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, it's feared three missing teenagers from East London may have travelled to Syria to become so-called jihadi brides. Caroline Henderson reports.
The girls, two aged 15, one 16, boarded a flight to Turkey on Tuesday. Commander Richard Walton's concerned.
The terrorist group calling itself the Islamic State treats young people, women and girls, in a particularly horrendous way.
Their school friend fled to Syria in December. Dr. Erin Saltman's an expert on women in extremism.
And within the UK alone, we have 50 plus female that have made a similar journey.
Campaigners like Anira Kokar say it's too easy for teens to travel to troubled regions.
It just looks bad on our security.
The girls are yet to make contact with their parents.
Jose Mourinho has condemned the ugly scenes witnessed on the Paris Metro this week. A group of Chelsea fans stopped a black businessman getting on a train on Tuesday night as racist chants came from the carriage. The manager says such supporters don't represent the club.
This is not Chelsea. They are not Chelsea. Chelsea is the owner, is the board, is the manager, is the players, is the people that works here, is the true Chelsea supporter.
A music teacher from one of the country's most prestigious art schools in London has been jailed for 11 years for historical sex attacks on two schoolgirls and a young woman. An Old Bailey judge said Philip Pickett was guilty of exceptionally serious sexual offences. A former special constable has admitted three charges of attempting to murder staff at the care home in West Bromwich where she worked. Melissa Swift put bleach into drinks which made 25 elderly residents and seven staff ill. A major hurdle has been cleared in Spurs' plans for a £400 million redevelopment of its White Hart Lane ground. A sheet metal firm in Tottenham wanted a compulsory purchase order, which is being used to force it out, quashed, but the High Court has rejected that. And scientists claim to have created the world's first beauty chocolate to reverse the appearance of ageing. The company behind Estechoc says it helps to smooth wrinkles in your skin. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Chris Giles.
If your New Year's resolution includes getting fit, Fitness for Less on Union Street is the place to go. With over 50 free classes per week, including yoga, Zumba, spin, insanity, and lots more. Large workout areas, a ladies-only gym, and single-sex saunas. It's no surprise that Fitness for Less is the people's choice. And if you pop in and quote BCFM, they'll give you a one-day free pass until the end of February. So, what are you waiting for? Check out Fitness for Less and see what they can do for you.
In a time of hunger, when your taste buds are calling out for Indian cuisine, there's one restaurant to rule them all. Delhi Cafe. Starring Milko Tali and Lamb Kofta Curry. And introducing Punjab Kebabs, cooked on a hot flat tava grill. With support from Kala Chanachet.
20% discount if you mention this advert. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Coming soon to a telly near you.
In Tune with Phil Vickery. Every Friday, 12 to 1 on BCFM. Independent, international, just interesting and innovative tunes. As well as reviews, chat and regular What Songs. Tune in to In Tune on Fridays with me, Phil Vickery, on BCFM.
It's Friday, folks. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, that's around St Paul's in the city centre, Rob Telford. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, when banks and corporations act like they're trashing our jobs, economy, legal aid and environment, when the legal system no longer delivers justice, favouring the rich, at what point do you say, well, enough is enough, I'm going to break the law? Would you take part in peaceful civil disobedience to make your point and even, maybe, to turn things round? A third nuclear power station at Hinkley Point is looking less and less likely. And while we're on the subject of energy, does oil and gas play a part in the conflict in Ukraine, just as it has in the Middle East? David Powell's here from Friends of the Earth. And the London media have got a blind spot with coups at the moment and the regime change agenda. Unreported coups in Venezuela, Yemen, and 1 year ago to the day. Still, they don't dare use the word for what happened in Kiev a year ago. Also, everything is changing in the already deliberately mysterious world of the economy. The EU's printing money and we're going into deflation. Prices apparently are going to fall. So we speak to economics professor Steve Keane. He says we need a Copernican revolution to knock out gravy train groupthink economists from their slumber. And an Italian general talks about the US intelligence blowing up his fellow countrymen as part of NATO's Operation Gladio. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows tonight of 3 degrees Celsius, some showers and possibly icy. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, temperatures nudging up, sunshine and showers on Saturday, wet and windy though on Sunday. Highs of 10 degrees Celsius next week, wet and windy for the beginning of the week, sunshine and showers for the remainder. Next weekend, the 28th of February and the 1st of March, highs of 10 Celsius, a fairly cloudy weekend with a few showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, Rob Telford. Hi, Rob. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. OK.
Now, tell us a little bit about your preparations for the local elections. Are you going to be actually up for election this year?
No, not myself. There are 23 or 24 wards around Bristol up for election this
year.
Are
there Greens standing in all of them?
Yes, we will be this time, yes. It's also a general election, as you know, and so we'll have MP candidates in all of the Bristol constituencies.
Okay,
as well.
Just run us through some of the people that we may know who will be standing in the general election too.
Well, in Bristol West constituency, so that's everywhere from all the way over in Clifton all the way over to Easton, we've got Darren Hall standing for the Greens. In Bristol South, we have Tony Dyer standing for the Greens. Bristol East, we have someone called Lorraine Francis. I think we've got our Kingswood candidate as well. She's called Cesara Nanu. So we have a mix of candidates, men and women.
So why not put some people who are already people who've got to know around Bristol as councillors? Why not put them up as potential MPs?
Well, it's different strokes for different folks. Some people like the local politics scene, and some people like going and spending 4 days a week in London. And essentially, we've just decided that those people wanted to come forward and wanted to do it. So they put their names forward, so that's who we went
okay,
with.
Okay, so give us a bit of an idea of what makes the Greens different, because one of the things we've talked to discuss quite a lot on here is this idea of a basic income. Now, obviously, many, many people out there are struggling with rents, don't have their own home and anywhere to live that's really secure, that they, you know, if they lose their job, for example, they're out. And one of the great ideas that the Green Party has been talking about for years is this basic income, and yet it looks like that's not going to be in the election manifesto. So what's going on with, why is it that some of the policies are being, you're saying, well, hang on a minute, it doesn't look like we're actually going to have this as a policy?
Well, there was an infamous interview recently with the Green Party leader Natalie Bennett on the Daily Politics show. Andrew Neil, the interviewer, took her to task really on how we'd pay for the basic income, and frankly we hadn't got it costed by that stage, and so that's led to
so Andrew Neil has decided really that the Green Party's not going to have this policy, is that right?
Not so much, but I think it's still our policy.
It does make you worried though, doesn't it, but that actually a lot of this is media led. I mean, you know, the idea is surely we want politicians who are going to be standing on their principles, not on what Andrew Neil's going to say to them on the BBC.
Well, you're quite right, but the basic income has to be costed before it becomes credible for the public, I think, and you have to show you're working on
it. So how are you going to cost, I mean, you know, what?
Well,
how would you pay for it? How are you thinking of paying for it, I suppose? You can't just have a policy without any idea of how you're going to pay for it.
I can't give an exact jot and tittle myself either, so that's speaking volumes, I suppose. But at the same time, we will be putting out a fully costed manifesto. For the last general election, we put out a fully costed manifesto, and Channel 4 News looked it over, got their economics experts onto it, and they couldn't find any problems with it. Unfortunately, they didn't run the story. So this time, hopefully, when we actually reveal our manifesto, and it will have a fully costed citizens' income pledge in it, I hope. I'm not sure, actually, what is going to happen with that, but hopefully we will have it in there, because we've had contradicting reports from different Green Party spokespeople. But I'm hoping it's in there, and I'm hoping it is costed, and hopefully from that point onwards we can then start to argue for it properly in public. And this is the difficulty I'm finding here, obviously, because I haven't got the costing. So.
Well, it's annoying because, I mean, one of the big problems is everyone's saying, oh, there's not enough money for this, not enough money for that. Is there actually enough money for a citizen's income, Martin?
There probably would be, but you've got to cost it out if you're going to put it in a manifesto. Mm. And it probably implies a degree of redistribution. In other words, you can do it. I mean, and there are plenty of savings to be made because you abolish things like mortgage tax relief, unemployment benefits, and so on. People have looked into this in the past and found that it's viable.
But what about the actual ultimate problem, which is where the money's coming from? That's coming from the private banking system. Surely it should be coming from the Treasury.
Well, that's another issue. I mean, reform of the financial system.
I mean, if you reform the financial system, you can do this kind of stuff.
I'm personally in favour of a citizen's income, which is rather unusual in mainstream Labour circles. But the problem is, it's such a radical policy that you're only going to find people being prepared to think of the redistribution involved if you've really got the bit between your teeth and people are saying, look, it's time to resolve this.
You mean like Greece or something?
Well, yeah, in places like Greece, it's the sort of thing that would come forward because people are in a more extreme state of mind. The mainstream media here have convinced people that there's some kind of economic recovery going on, even though it's based on money printing and property bubbles. And it's very difficult to get these new ideas, things like citizens' income, off the ground because there's a barrage of conventional thinking to be got through. And one of the problems with our electoral system is that new ideas like this don't get flown because it's difficult to get a foothold with them.
It's not that new an idea, though, in a sense, is it?
It's been around for ages.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time. And the other thing to say, I mean, you're talking about the context in Greece that could be, you know, fertile ground, but actually it's also right people on the right of politics who have proposed it as a way of limiting tax. What I think is most important is that we actually have a clear understanding of what it means, and we know that it's not an in-work benefit. It's a benefit that is going to give people the chance to have much more freedom in their work lives and in their actual lives, because we aren't just, you know, just
workers.
It
might be worth explaining to people who are listening what the basic idea of it is. I mean, if effectively what you do, and it's been argued from the right and from the left, Milton Friedman called it negative income tax, but it's the same basic idea. I mean, one of the big inefficiencies with paying benefits is the whole means testing involved. Yeah. You've got to check everybody's bank accounts. Every time their circumstances change, you've got to recalculate it. What you do with the citizens' income is you abolish all... You get rid of all of existing benefits, and of course you have to get rid of things like tax relief on houses and so on as well. Middle class benefits have to be, and then everybody who is on the electoral register gets a basic income, so that if you do become ill or you lose your job or whatever, your basic living standard is looked after, and you can see that the kind of peace of mind that would give people would be enormous, and also it would allow the flexibilisation of the labour market. This is why the right wing like the idea, because it means that people really could have a choice about how many hours they wanted to work, fit their work around their family commitments and so on. But we're still a long way from the mainstream accepting this. Think of all the kind of persecution complex that there is about people on benefits in the mainstream media. It's a huge challenge to that kind of work ethic, Arbeit macht frei, which is both major parties.
We'll be hearing a bit about that later, actually. Yeah. Anyway, let's also discuss. I mean, we saw that the mayor this week We were just saying, weren't we, last week on the show about how the Bristol Post seems to be like some giant advertising campaign for Mayor Ferguson. And lo and behold, this week he's caught speeding, and it's on the front page of the Post. George looking a little bit guilty, possibly. I don't know. Maybe he's looking into the distance. I'm not sure if he's aware he's even being photographed. But anyway, I don't want to talk about that because it's a sort of very, very light story, isn't it? You know, oh, you're done for doing speeding in a 20-mile-an-hour limit. It's not so.
Was he on his bike?
No, in his little car.
Oh,
I think,
right.
In a council car. But actually, I thought I'd turn actually to the page four of that paper, which is Tuesday's Post, with an interesting story about Vincent Tabak. Now, he's the guy who was convicted of murdering Joe Yates back in December 2010. I think he was a Dutch chap. But bizarrely, I mean, the story says Tabak faces string of child porn charges. Well, this is actually a lot of nasty, violent pornography that he had, and none of this was allowed to be included in the original case. Also, the other thing is, in this article here in the Post, there's not even a reference made to the fact that of the Joe Yates murder. It's almost as if there's some deliberate attempt to keep this separate, even though it looks to me as if this may well have had some sort of relevance to the murder, because his violent porn he was looking at. Anyway, what's your thoughts about this latest revelation about Vincent Tabak, Rob?
I haven't seen the story. I mean, that's the first I've seen it. So that does sound like they're trying to, shift onto a different story, away from the fact that he was convicted of that crime.
Why, Martin, why not a single mention of the fact that he was involved in
well,
the murder case?
Presumably... I mean,
that's not good journalism.
No, presumably, though, in the first place, it wasn't brought forward because it was regarded as prejudicial to his trial for murder. I imagine that's why it wasn't brought up at the original trial. But of course, if he's now being separately charged with child pornography, well, so be it if he's guilty.
There is a certain cognitive dissonance to the way the Post sometimes report things. It doesn't link things up and it doesn't show the whole picture. That's the difficulty, I suppose, in local journalism at the moment, is a lot of people aren't connecting the dots. I mean, for instance, this week we had the budget, and I don't know whether you're coming on to that later, but the report from the Post just doesn't summarise the entire meeting.
Okay, well, you were there, so yeah. give us a bit of a critique of the Post's coverage.
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's anyone else who sat in a 7-hour meeting this week, but I did, and it was the thing about council meetings. You have to remember a lot of this stuff gets sorted out behind the scenes before the meeting even starts. So effectively, what you're doing is a lot of speech mongering, a lot of making speeches in order to put things on leaflets in order to stand for election. There's definitely an element of that. What the Post reported was that the council tax bills are to rise by almost 2%. It doesn't give any context to, you know, whether there was a reason for that, what the point of that was. It just says the basic fact that they're going up.
It's a sort of fait accompli. It's not actually giving you the background and fleshing out the argument. This is why you're going to have to be paying more, probably, for what is £30 million of cuts, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, and that's the thing. And many local councils across the country of all political persuasions, even Conservative, have rejected the council tax freeze that the government has given us because they see it as a way of protecting services. If you increase council tax below inflation, then you're likely to be able to protect more services than you would if you don't. And that's the simple fact of the matter with local government at the moment, is that we're being absolutely just devastated by the coalition's cuts. And so anything that we can do to save vital services in the city, we're gonna consider. And that's why it went up. I mean, it wasn't just the mayor who agreed with it. It was three of the four political parties. So, but that isn't really alluded to too much.
Okay, I think you better just explain that a bit more, because this is so what has Bristol done that they shouldn't have done if they wanted to keep the council tax frozen? Because why on earth should we be paying any more at all for services which are being denuded, cut all the time? I mean, particularly things like mental health, elderly care, all this kind of stuff is going downhill.
I mean, in terms of inflation, you're not actually going to be... I mean, you're paying 2% more, but actually, in terms of inflation, that isn't the case. What I think is important to remember is that there isn't really any other way for local councils to raise revenue in terms of our tax base. The only way we can do it is by raising council tax. The government offers it's kind of like a bribe to local councils to take the council tax freeze, so they don't have to, which would effectively mean that we'd have to cut more services.
But don't some Cliftonites have money in tax havens?
Yeah, I mean, that would be what I would say. I mean, council tax isn't really progressive at the end of the day.
Do they have money in HSBC Swiss bank accounts? Martin, indeed, I mean, does seem, doesn't it, that central government has completely hamstrung local government by saying, look, you just can't do anything. I mean, particularly things like housing, which is so desperately needed, they're not allowed to build it.
Well, I mean, council tax really is poll tax Mark II, and it's levied on individuals rather than on property. And in actual fact, if we'd had the old-fashioned rates and business rates, that would give local government a great deal more independence than it currently has. And that's exactly why Thatcher abolished it, because she was unhappy about the fact that in Lambeth, in particular where I was living at the time, residents in Streatham were being charged rates on their houses to pay for youth clubs in Brixton. And she was saying, well, the people in Brixton are going to keep voting for youth clubs as long as they don't have to pay for them, so what we're going to do is make sure that they do have to pay for them. But of course it was a silly idea. And we're still, all these years later, we've still got a completely dysfunctional local government finance set up.
Yeah.
After 13 years of Labour government, nothing was done about it either.
OK, Rob, you've had your moan about the Bristol Post. We do it here pretty regularly. Ian Onions, if you're listening, come on, have a chat with us. I'm fed up with leaving messages on your answer phone saying, come and have a chat on the radio. What are your thoughts generally about the state of the local press in Bristol?
Well, we've got what should be seen as one normal newspaper you can buy in the shops, which is the Bristol Post, and that doesn't really give you the broad sweep of what is going on, at least socio-politically in the city. It doesn't really get to the grips with all of that.
Okay, well, what about the sort of influences and biases that you think might be there? Because, I mean, I certainly detect quite a lot of support for the mayor and generally for the sort of city elders, the merchant venturers, the people that own the city seem to be supported by the Post.
That they have their interests. I mean, I can't go into the details of their interests because they're just so multifarious is that you can't list all of the interests that the Post has in terms of its ownership, in terms of the people who are involved in it. For me, it's less about looking at the Post and saying, well, that's terrible. It's more about looking at the alternatives and trying to find them. You know, we've got things springing up now. We've got this investigative journalism publication called Bristol Cable, which is now publishing every 2 months, I think. And they're doing great things to sort of highlight and weed out some of the sort of scandals that are going on in the city.
I think it's good for young people, because most young people find the TV and the Bristol Post boring, basically unintelligent, and it's just like you're basically just reproducing a bunch of press releases.
Completely. And we also lost a little bit of shine in the city from Bristol 24/7 being taken over by a sort of cultural magazine. It's become much more of a sort of listings magazine and less like a sort of a genuine news source, and that's been an issue as well.
Because Chris Brown, who was on this show last year actually, was talking about he'd been into council meetings, he was being quite critical, he was doing some real good hard news stories. And then Mike Bennett and Dougal Templeton came in, Mike Bennett being the placemaking chap, you know, from See No Evil. So it's a kind of, you know, putting Bristol on the map and bringing in graffiti artists from other parts of the world. Yeah. Maybe not paying quite as much as you should have done for some of our local graffiti artists, for example. And then bringing in Martin Booth and putting him in charge, where actually it was Chris's publication that he'd started. I mean, that must have been very galling for Chris as something that he started. And also, another thing I noticed with Bristol 24/7 is massive amounts of the news from the last four or so years have disappeared off the internet.
Yeah, they just completely wiped their archive, and that is frustrating, particularly for people like me who want to self-publicise. They can't get access to their articles anymore.
It's become a sort of cafe review thing rather than a newspaper, which is a real pity. So that's something else that's fallen, you know, by the wayside. Anyway, I mean, you know, if you want to know which cafe to go to, fine. But if you want to know, you know, who the shenanigans about what's going on in the city council, you need to listen to us and people like you, Rob. Anyway, tell us a bit about, because are you still a Green Party whip?
I am.
What do you do as a whip? You know, it sounds
not an awful lot.
Like,
to be honest.
You've got a dangerous man to know.
I mean, at the council budget meeting this week, you know, we had a few conversations. I get approached by the other whips and asked, "Are you going to support certain motions or amendments?"
Oh, I see. Right.
Like that.
Okay.
But that's pretty much it. It's not really much of a role in the council, and I don't use the whip. In the Green Party, we don't believe in whipping votes, so telling people how to vote. So, effectively, my job is to sort of internally organised.
So you just have
councils.
To send a text and people just vote the way you want?
No. That is definitely not what happens, Tony, and I want to put that very plainly on there.
Okay,
on
well, we're into the budget. We've just talked a little bit about the budget. What are your thoughts about what's the way things are going this year? Because I think it's £350 million you have to spend of our money every year.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, the whole budget debate was framed around this 3.9 million we'd found extra down the back of the sofa, sort of. Basically from people paying too much council tax. And so we got this opportunity to sort of consult on this, and effectively that is what the majority of the debate in the council chamber was about. And so all the different political groups put their amendments in, and mostly they're to take things out the mayor's put in and put their own little pet project in. Completely unsustainable, because all they're doing is putting the money in for 1 year. So what we were trying to do as the Green Group is find amendments that were either sustainable or you can find the money from elsewhere. One of the ones that we did do was about the residence parking scheme, which I'm loath to bring up on radio, but at the same time it is quite a good thing, is that we managed to get disabled blue badge holders to get free parking within residence parking.
Well, they should
schemes.
Do that anyway.
Well, they should, but it wasn't in the scheme, was it? And we managed to amend it so that it was. So hopefully that will come in. And the only way we were able to do that was we could say, oh, we'll pay back the loan on residence parking schemes 4 months later. So it's little things like that you have to know, the little secrets and little nooks and crannies of the council to be able to sort of get anything done without taking money out of other things that might need it. So that's effectively where we are with the budget, is people putting in their own pet projects and hoping that others support them.
I'll give you your two hopes on the local press as well, Martin. What are your thoughts about, you know, sort of who owns the press and how that determines what we see? Because we've got a general election coming up. We want fair coverage, don't we?
Well, I think that there isn't enough variety in the opinions that people are presented with.
Yeah.
And also there's too many vested interests. I mean, the story about Bristol 24/7 is very instructive, isn't it? It's an independent journalistic endeavour set up by journalists with journalistic aspirations. Then, of course, they need resources in order to fulfil what they're doing. Big Daddy comes along with some resources, and before you know it, the journalists are out and Big Daddy's in control. And that's an object lesson in how things work, isn't it?
Well, it's not just here in Bristol that this sort of thing goes on, because there was quite an extraordinary announcement on Monday from the Daily Telegraph's chief political correspondent, Peter Oborne, because he was saying that what's happening at the Daily Telegraph is a disaster, because the Telegraph's biggest one of the Telegraph's biggest advertisers, HSBC, has been caught up in this massive 1,000 people tax scandal over in Switzerland, as well as many other things, including money laundering for the bloody Mexican drug cartels, has actually been influencing policy at the an editorial policy at the Daily Telegraph. So anyway, rather than me waffling on about it, let's have a listen to Peter Oborne and see what he had to say this week on the BBC.
But when I started to get cross was when I tried to write a story about HSBC myself, and it just couldn't get in the paper. People kept on sort of putting it off. They didn't quite say it wouldn't get in, but it just never did, if you know what I mean.
Did they say it was wrong or just not?
They just didn't get... I was told for one moment that there was a legal problem, but I went to the lawyers and they said they're not aware of a legal problem, and then they said they'd get it in, and then it never appeared. And I just gave up in despair in the end. Mm. And then I thought, well, I'm now going to see if there's anything in these stories by HSBC. And I made some very thorough research of the coverage of HSBC. And basically, negative stories about HSBC didn't get into the paper. There was a particularly notorious example of a banking correspondent called Harry Wilson, who wrote a piece about HSBC's black hole in its accounts, which... went online, and then it was offline very shortly afterwards. And who had made that decision? Who had taken it offline? Had it followed pressure from HSBC? These are the sort of questions I wanted to find out the answer to. It's a sort of, and that's a typical of, and I discovered that was a part of a pattern.
A pattern? Go on then.
Well, and it came to a head last week when the BBC, the Panorama, did that superb programme into the HSBC's Swiss banking arm, and Telegraph coverage of it was minimal. And that's the moment I thought I'm going to go public. I was too cross. By the way, there are important questions for HSBC here too. I mean, The Guardian has a very important revelation today that HSB advertising was put, quotes, unquotes, on pause as The Guardian started to investigate the Swiss banking arm of HSBC. So there's a pattern here. That same thing happened to The Telegraph. I think actually it's an important point that we need to put to HSBC, you need to have them on this show and ask them, why did you put the Guardian advertising on pause last week. Why did you put the Telegraph advertising on pause 2 years ago? Because it looks to the outsider as if they're using advertising as a means of... I would say it came from management. I would corporate executives. And I think in the Telegraph there needs to be an inquiry now into the connections between the advertising and the editorial department.
It was ever thus, wasn't it, Peter? There's bound to be...
No.
They're bound to twitch a bit when one of their main advertisers is suddenly the object of a story.
Look, it's been don't accept that. It's a bit axiomatic in quality journalism that you don't have a connection of the kind we've been seeing, apparently been seeing here, between the advertising and news. The reader who buys the paper, the Daily Telegraph reader, has got to read the news in the knowledge that he's being told the truth, not but he's being told the version of the world as the advertiser wants to see it. I have never seen anything as egregious as this before. Actually, if you read Nick Davies' excellent book on journalism, he says it doesn't happen. I mean, he says in terms, in that book which taught journalism to shreds, brilliant book actually, he said for all the many problems that journalism had, he said that the clash of interest between advertising and news didn't happen.
Didn't happen. Sorry, I missed just the end of that clip. But Rob, this is pretty frightening in a way, isn't it? HSBC has got massive, massive resources, the biggest bank, I think one of the biggest in the world. And if they are calling the shots in our London newsrooms, we've really got a problem on our hands.
Yeah, HSBC, the world's local bank. I mean, it's very interesting that Peter Obon has had to resign over this. It shows that he's got integrity in terms of what he's doing as a journalist. But it shows, you know, hugely how when these financial institutions, banks, financiers, anyone else who's involved in the financial system at the high level, uses their power and influence over our media, how damaging that can be and how quickly it can get out. And they should use this actually as a cautionary tale, because it shows that if you are trying to wield influence over the media in this way and tamper with the free press, you can get caught out. And so I'm hoping that as the days go on and we find out more and more about this story, we will figure out how deep it goes and how HSB have been using their influence over...
Well, look, the trouble is, Martin, Peter Obon is one principal journalist. For every one Peter Obon, there's hundreds of other journalists who are afraid to lose their jobs.
Well, indeed, and that's the way the world works. I mean, the idea that this doesn't happen and this is all the terribly shocking, I mean, the fact of the matter is it's been going on for years. And as you know, Tony, we investigated the Barclay Brothers Empire Building in Sark, where they've built their own James Bond-style castle.
This is the owners of the
Brecu.
Telegraph. The owners of the Daily Telegraph.
And that what they're trying to do in Sark is take the place over completely by controlling all local media and attempting to control the democratic process in Sark rather unsuccessfully. But of course it was the Telegraph that were given the hard drive of all MPs' expenses.
The stolen hard drive,
that's right, stolen by an ex-SAS guy who was bankrupt. I've forgotten his name now, John something. So it was when that first came out, Michael Martin, who was the speaker, actually called the police in and said, look, this isn't a leak. Somebody's broken into the office here and stolen the hard drive. And what the Barclay brothers did, and we know that it was discussed with Cameron because he flew out to Sark to talk about it with them on their island, the locals told us about that before the last election, is that certain MPs had their expenses thrown out to the public and they were dragged over the coals. Other MPs who were satisfactory from the Barclay brothers' point of view did not have their expenses exposed, including, for example, Tony Blair, who'd been such a useful, helpful little boy for so long that there was absolutely no reason why his expenses should be exposed. And I think that they used that quite cynically. Cameron used it quite cynically to remove dead wood in the Tory party from his point of view, but various mainstream MPs did not have their even though the Barclay brothers had full information of all of their expenses, they were given a buy because that's the kind of power that they like to exercise. And of course, people in Sark, population 600, are very well aware of the Barclay brothers' extremely power-oriented way of doing business.
Well, it's actually quite bullying as well, wasn't it? Putting up black propaganda, for example, posters.
That's right. Yes, they put
election time.
Posters up. They tried to get their people elected onto the council at Sark. Chief, please. They didn't get anybody elected, so they then sacked all of their employees on the island, several hundred people, as a punishment, collective punishment for the Sarkese. But of course, Sark was occupied by the Germans during World War II, and they don't take very kindly to being pushed around by the Barclay brothers. That's a big story, which the mainstream media have largely ignored.
It's also the BBC, at least some people say, are a culprit of this. We're going to hear now two clips from the BBC, and it's a programme which was called Saving Syria's Children, a documentary which was made in the summer of 2013. I just wonder if you could just put this into context, Martin, as to what was going on at the time, because there was this horrific Ghouta chemical weapons attack, supposedly anyway, by Bashar al-Assad on his own people.
Yeah, but all the evidence subsequently, particularly as gathered by Seymour Hersh, who was probably the senior serious journalist in the US, points the finger firmly at the al-Nusra front, working with the MIT, which is the Turkish intelligence service, and the Saudis, who are allies of MI6. So all that stuff about, if they're going to use chemical weapons, that's a red line and we're going to have to do something, it looks like quite possibly NATO intelligence service, including MIT and MI6, were involved. What should we do? Should we bomb GCHQ? What do you think?
No, I don't think right now.
I'm just pointing out that there was an awful lot of talk of what needed to be done when people use chemical weapons, and it now turns out that NATO with the rebels use chemical weapons. Surely the RAF should be sent to do some bombing, shouldn't they? That's what they were going to be told to do in Syria.
Now, the programme again was called Saving Syria's Children. It was a documentary broadcast in summer 2013. And what you're going to hear now, first of all, is a news report, and then the subsequent use of that news report and footage that was taken over in Syria on this documentary. The reason we know about this is because somebody called Robert Stewart took this to the BBC right the way through all their complaints processes and has finally had his final appeal rejected. But anyway, if you can see why he was complaining, if you have a listen to the two versions of that interview with this woman doctor in Saving Syria's Children, first of all then on the news and then in the documentary.
Among the medics here was a British doctor visiting for the charity Hand in Hand.
I need a pause because it's just absolute chaos and carnage here. We've had a massive influx of what looked like serious burns. It seems like it must be some sort of, I'm not really sure, maybe napalm, something similar to that.
Last month, we were filming the doctors working at this hospital when victims of an incendiary bomb attack on a school playground started pouring in. Their burns suggested the bomb was filled with a napalm-like substance.
It's just absolute chaos and carnage here. We've had a massive influx of what looked like serious burns. It seems like it must be some sort of chemical weapon. I'm not really sure.
Well, as you heard the first time, it's napalm. The second time, it's chemical weapons. But you see, the way you can do that with television is pretty simple. You just edit the audio track and you have a cutaway, maybe a picture of one of the children, and then you cut back to the interview. And it's a way of kind of cloaking editing that's been going on in a face-to-face interview. I think that's a pretty much a sackable offence. Possibly should be imprisonable if you're trying to make a case for war using that kind of footage. Anyway, Rob, what can we do, do you think, to get round some of this media spin and potentially as well lies that are being told to us through the mainstream press, mainly the London lot?
Well, in the case of Syria, I don't know the full detail, so I'm going to have to leave Martin to talk about that. But in terms of the mainstream media, it is often the case that we have stories that get put up on national news media websites, run in news bulletins, that haven't been sufficiently, they haven't either been proven, or they put stuff in that is basically there just to tell us what they want us to think.
Well, you're
about
thinking
it.
About maybe weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Or
well, that's
like
one
that.
Example, isn't it? I mean, that's the most obvious example, I suppose. But no, we need to always be aware that there's always an element of bias to all of the media's portrayals of things, and particularly when it comes to war, there is this thing we get where we don't hear all of the information at the right time, because it's often a case that it's very, very quickly announced that we might potentially be going to war against someone. And particularly with Syria, that was the case, where we had all the MPs rushing back to Parliament to try and vote on it, where the information gathered from that short period of time probably wasn't sufficient to be able to say whether it was the right thing to do. So I'm most interested in what we can do to make sure that happens, and how the media can change its ways, really, because it's been a very long time that this has been the case.
Well, what can we do, though,
complex
as readers, viewers, what can we do?
Well, I mean, you've got to make your feelings known to them.
Throw the TV out the window?
Well, if you feel so incensed by it, yes, but I don't know whether that'll fix it. But I would say, yeah, get in contact with the media and complain to the BBC if there's something you think is biased, or if you think that is coming from a particular standpoint because they're trying to sort of propagate it, then that needs to be something you complain about.
Okay, Martin?
Well, I think I agree with all of that, but there's another factor. I mean, the British Army have just set up a cyber warfare battalion who are going to have 2,000 guys who are sitting there trying to steer the media in various directions. And we've certainly seen this in Syria, where essentially interested parties are fabricating stories to achieve certain desired ends. So there was a case of a Norwegian filmmaker who filmed in Malta, supposedly a scene in Syria of a brave Syrian boy trying to rescue his sister under sniper fire, and then when everybody, it was all picked up by the international media, isn't this terrible, blah 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 blah, and then he came out and said, well, actually I made that in Malta as a you know, with Maltese actors, and I did it because I'm so much in favour of trying to have an intervention in Syria, I thought I was doing the right thing. Now, that's just one case of this. What we're now finding, modern psychological warfare officers are engaged in the conscious manipulation of facts and information in order to achieve political goals. And I think the answer to it is, every time they do it and we find it out, we beat them over the head with it. I come back to what I said earlier. The evidence now suggests that NATO intelligence services using sarin from Libya were involved in that chemical weapons attack. I would suggest that when President Obama and others said that was a red line and if they crossed it, the Syrians would have to be punished, I would suggest that MI6, CIA, MIT have crossed that red line. They use chemical weapons on civilians. That's the evidence. And I suggest that at that point, maybe we shouldn't send the RAF to bomb them, but we should certainly send the police to arrest them and put them on trial. That is actually a perfectly reasonable demand.
Okay, well, back a bit more locally. We've had quite a lot of robotic stories recently about Bristol. An £80,000 robot hospital porter. Well, actually, several of them have been bought for Southmead Hospital. I'm not sure quite how many ordinary porters that replaces. Also, driverless cars are being introduced in Bristol, which sounds like a total disaster. I don't know who the first child knocked down by one of those is going to, the parents are going to blame. But also, a robotic pharmacy up at Southmead. What are your thoughts about robotics and the replacement of human work or whatever by these robots?
Well, I've actually seen the Southmead. I went for a tour of Southmead Hospital recently in my role as people vice chair on the council. So we went and looked at them. They are bizarre. I mean, they are odd things. They just sort of like scuttle around, and apparently have some kind
but
of,
but I mean, the £80,000 a piece, you do wonder, I mean, if that lasts for maybe 5-6 years before it conks out, I mean, that's, you could have had a couple of hospital porters.
I'm not entirely sure the purpose of them. That wasn't explained actually when I went there, so yeah,
maybe
so
it's to line the pockets of the technology companies,
well,
that design them,
it right, does
and,
seem
and that being done by whoever it is that's behind that particular PFI, possibly HSBC again.
Yeah, I mean, it's potentially the case. In terms of the driverless cars, I mean, I just think, isn't this just the height of laziness? I mean, it's symptomatic of our society that we want a driverless car. It's that we believe that we are in the future or something, that therefore we must have driverless cars.
It's a symptom, I think, of quite a lot of demanning, which has been going on for decades, Martin.
Well, Bill Gates has pointed out that robotics have the potential to remove virtually everything that we do. So in other words, even brain surgery can be done by robots. In fact, brain surgery probably more easily than many other things. But of course, this comes back to our citizens' income argument earlier. If we are moving towards a society in which our technology is so good that we can actually have machines to do most of it, what are people for? And that's why you've got to say, well, actually, we've got to give people an independent income independent of whether they are employed or not. Yeah. And we will move towards a society with less work and more stuff, and also keep it potentially using less materials. So, in other words, we have a vision of what we used to call a future socialist society, where we will actually try and work less. I mean, productivity per hour in France is higher than in Germany, but they have a lower GDP because they take their holidays seriously. And we've got to start thinking like that, and that's actually the positive agenda to get us out of the crisis.
Yeah, there was a fairly influential report that the New Economics Foundation did 3 or 4 years ago now, called 21 Hours, and that was about how we need to move towards a working week where we are doing 21 hours, and that would give enough jobs for everyone to feel fulfilled in their lives, perhaps in keeping, in conjunction with the citizen's income, but it made a very strong case that that is the way that you solve some of the employment issues in Britain, is you give more jobs, but spread over more people, as it were.
Well, Martin,
is that Green Party policy then?
What, to make the working week shorter? Yes, it is, but I think it's only... I think this general election, I think we're going in with 35 hours to start with. So there's a measly 35 hours, so small reform. But I think that in the long term, yes, definitely 21 hours is more what we need to be looking at, and that being the sort of maximum work week almost.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And if you don't do this, of course, the system doesn't work. Because what's happening with robotics is it's removing workers from the production process. Real wages all over the world, not just in Britain, are being squeezed. And then the workers haven't got enough money to buy back what's been produced without being lent money by Wonga. Now, the way around that is to redistribute wealth and income to the whole society, and use the technology as a means of empowering communities and individuals.
Well, an interesting vision, Martin, but let's hear David Cameron's vision now, because he set that out earlier on this week as part of the run-up to this May's general election.
People don't have the chance to develop their skills. Our companies become less competitive in the world.
David Miliband.
Now, why is this happening? It's not because we aren't industrious. We actually work some of the longest hours in Europe. It's not because we don't have a work ethic. It's not because our young people don't want to succeed. You disprove that idea here at JLR. No, it's because we have historic weaknesses as a country, which in truth no government has addressed. We haven't recognised what I think is the most important economic idea of the 21st century. That wealth doesn't simply come from a few at the top, either individuals or companies, but it flows from every working person. Every single person is a wealth creator.
Well, that's an easy thing to say, Martin, but you're not a wealth creator if you haven't actually got enough money to even pay the bills and you're working all the hours God sends.
Well, I mean, the idea that wealth is collectively produced, I think, is just a truism. It's obvious that that's the case. And of course he's trying to make the right sort of noises there, but of course it's not a truly radical vision.
He's talking about upskilling the workforce. That was the nub of his argument on Tuesday.
Yeah, but the robots are going to be more skilled than the people in the long run, and that's the bigger question that we were just addressing.
Rob, what do you think of what Ed had to say there? Sorry, I call him David. Ed Miliband.
It's a very... I mean, the way that Ed's rhetoric there is very aspirational, isn't it? He's trying to sort of tap into this idea that we're all part of this great big picture. But I don't think a lot of... I mean, as Martin says, is there a lot of people down right at the bottom of society who will hear that and go, what wealth have I created? You know, what have I actually done? And I agree that, you know, that is the way that we're, you know, collectively we create wealth.
You're creating wealth for somebody else most of the time, aren't
you? That's the thing, and that's what we need to see change. And I find it quite hard to pass words said by Ed Miliband. It isn't always clear the philosophical implications and the political implications of what he's saying. Just a bit more detail would be quite handy.
Well, let's try properly now David Cameron and his vision. So let's have a listen to what he had to say on Monday.
Next Parliament, we'd take further steps to make sure young people don't get sucked into a life on welfare. About 10% of 18 to 21 year olds who go to the job centre to make a claim are what are known in the jargon as NEETs. They've not been in employment or education or training for more than 6 months before they sign on. They drift from school to worklessness to benefits, and we don't ask enough of them. Now, of course, the best thing is for young people not to fall into activity in the first place. And we're doing a whole range of things to stop that from happening, whether it's raising the education school leaving age, whether it's increasing apprenticeships or creating a new careers company to give young people guidance. But if they have drifted into a life of inactivity, then it's pretty clear what these young people really need, and it is work experience. They need the order and discipline of turning up for work each day. So a Conservative government would require them to do daily community work from the very start of their claim for unemployment benefit, as well as searching for work. From day one, they must play their part and make an effort. That could mean making meals for older people, cleaning up litter and graffiti, working for local charities. Your first experience of the benefit system should be, yes, you can get help, but it isn't something for nothing. You need to put something back into your community at the same time.
Well, it all sounds quite good, but in the background there, obviously you couldn't see it, was a big banner saying, "A Britain that rewards work." Meanwhile, David Cameron there is talking about getting young people to work for nothing.
Well, indeed. I mean, the big problem with all of this is when you say, if we're going to provide work for everybody, then we've got to give up the idea of a free market economy. Because in actual fact, the government will provide work for you. But it's more expensive than providing benefits. Who's going to supervise these young people as they do all of this community work? Oh, well, the government will have to do that. And the taxpayer will have to pay for it. The reason why we give benefits in the way we do is because just giving benefits without any advice and all the rest of it, or providing jobs, is the cheapest option. Now, if you were serious about putting all the people out of the neets to work, then we're going to have to raise taxes, I'm afraid, David, on people like you. That's the only way to do it. And I think perhaps if you were to argue that, I might agree with you. But to say that somehow we're going to make these people work, but we're going to do it, that the government's going to have to do this and it isn't going to cost anything, is absurd. And what it is cod sociology, because the real macroeconomic questions facing us, that we've been money printing for 5 years, that there's an unsustainable housing bubble, that there's going to be a global crash, is above David Cameron's head. So let's just stick to the simple stuff about how teenagers should be made to get out of bed in the morning, because even idiots can understand that.
Rob, you're the Green councillor for Ashley Waugh. What do you make of Cameron's vision for young people, particularly there?
Well, one of the first things he said in that clip was, we don't ask enough of them. I think if anyone has encountered the education system in the UK between the ages of, and I count from birth to 18 in this, it's pretty stringent. It's pretty testy. It's pretty examination heavy. Young people actually, from the period from the, when they're about 11 years old up to the age of 18, have so much to go through, and they, and the idea that he can then just fob them off and say they're not getting enough, we're not asking enough of them, is ridiculous. And then when you get to 18, often a lot of young people don't know what they want to do with their lives. I didn't know what I wanted to do in my life when I was 18. I probably still don't now. But the point is that you can't just say, oh, let's shove them into some community workfare scheme. Oh, that'll sort it all out. That isn't the way to sort it out. It's to give young people a sense of, oh, what do you want to do? And ask them that question. And say, you know, it might be 6 months of being on a dole and then get a job. But that's the way things work. And people have to decide in their own time what they want to do with their life.
OK, on to another story now. Met Police pay-to-protest proposal is rejected by campaigners. This is from yesterday's Guardian. 12 campaigning groups say they will refuse to pay for private traffic management for their protests, a duty previously carried out by Scotland Yard. This is part of the cuts, I imagine, Martin, that people who are going to organise a demonstration, including one with maybe 2 or 3 million people, like the anti-Iraq demonstration back in 2003, you're going to have to pay the police to police it.
Well, I would suggest in that case the answer from the protest groups is, we are not going to organise a traffic management business for this, and we're just going to protest. We're not even going to communicate with you. We're just going to protest whenever and wherever we feel like, and if we're blocking the traffic, that's just too bad. The idea that those who organise protests should have to put up money. I mean, lots of people are protesting because they haven't got any money. So organisations then have to put up money to protest about not having any money. It's completely wrong, and it's unworkable in any case. People will protest when they are upset, and they are not going to make agreements with the police about having it organised to make sure that there's a traffic plan in place. I'm afraid if the police don't want to organise the traffic, then there'll just be a demonstration with the traffic isn't organised, which will be chaotic, but then I'm afraid that's what freedom looks like, and the police are not doing their job.
Rob, what are your thoughts about this? Because, I mean, for a lot of people organising a protest, say in London or whatever, if the police are saying, well, you can't have your protest unless you hand over the readies, they're not going to like that, are they?
No. I mean, it's ridiculous. This is a complete attack on freedom of association. I mean, I think the whole Parliament Square debacle over the last, you know, well, what now, 12, 13 years, where people have been unable to protest outside their own Parliament, is a case in point. Is we must have the right to protest on the streets. There are streets. They're not the government streets. There are streets. And the fact that this is being even mooted, and even in the media, is bizarre to me. And it's against what...
Well, this is the
even the Conservatives
the Metropolitan
talk about.
Police. The Metropolitan Police are behind this. So,
well, I mean, yes, but I mean, there should be some way of the government stepping in and saying this can't happen.
Well, can I just mention, since we're mentioning the Metropolitan Police, let's mention Inspector Chris Covington, who I saw outside Downing Street several years ago, trying to start a riot on a Stop the War demonstration. He was identified by a fellow protester as somebody that he had met at a party the previous night and said he was a police inspector. We identified him. He was definitely trying to start a riot. Police Inspector Chris Covington.
Well, when you say when you say he's trying to start a riot, what was he doing?
He was running around going and trying to turn over the barriers and trying to get everybody going. And then he was recognised as a police officer, and we identified him, Chris Covington, Inspector Chris Covington from North London. No punishment, nothing at all, not even a disciplinary.
Agent provocateur.
Agent provocateur, indeed. And, of course, the Metropolitan Police have got a pretty bad reputation for things like that, including trying to infiltrate totally illegally various protest movements, including to the level of giving people babies and then walking away and leaving the state with the bill. Maybe the Metropolitan Police needs to have a word with itself, and perhaps we should be thinking of abolishing them.
There's also another related story to do with the policy by the government, which is supposed to sort of stop Islamic extremists, and Nafiz Ahmed's written an amazing piece about this on medium.com. He was the guy that was actually elbowed out from The Guardian after criticising Israelis' ambitions to gas in Palestine. He says the powers of the new legislation are unprecedented. It's the government will be able to unilaterally confiscate passports of British citizens suspected of involvement in terrorism, even though the threshold for exactly what constitutes a reasonable suspicion is ambiguous. Terror suspects deemed as such not on the basis of fair trial but purely through secret hearings based on secret evidence provided by the security services can already be subjected to constant monitoring, electronic tagging and travel bans, limited house arrest and curfew under the Terrorism Prevention and Investigation Measures. The CST bill, this new bill, will now add forced relocation to that mix. Now, this is pretty shocking. I haven't seen a lot of coverage about this in the mainstream press either. But this new bill, Martin, sounds pretty shocking, actually.
Well, it does, and especially...
Just let me explain. It's the Counter-Terrorism and Security Bill, and it's just received the Royal Assent this week.
Well, let's just rewind the videotape here a bit. And we constantly talk in this programme, week after week, about the overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have been involved with terrorism over the years. Think back to the 1980s, Operation Cyclone, when Al-Qaeda was originally created with MI6 as the lead agency to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. Now, I would suggest that we need to look much more closely at the intelligence services' links with terrorists. And that's the sort of thing that everybody, for example, in Ireland, from whatever side of the political divide they are on, would recognise as a necessary thing. Now, in actual fact, we've already got plenty of good laws against terrorism. We've got plenty of laws against agent provocateur behaviour, for example. Chris Covington should have been charged with incitement to riot. He wasn't charged with incitement to riot. He wasn't even disciplined.
Well, it sounds like there's quite a lot of big offences, like the child abuse, for example, which seem to be being swept under the carpet.
Indeed. So the more power to the state on the back of these terrorist incidents, which raise more questions than they provide answers, is really, really not the way to go. But, of course, the Strategia di Tensione in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, run by NATO's intelligence services, investigated by the Italian police force. It's quite clear what you do. You carry out terrorist incidents, and on the back of that, the secret state then comes forward and says they need more powers. But they, in fact, are actually flagging up that they may well be the perpetrators.
Anyway, Rob, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, this latest the bill. You know, this is pretty. I mean, it looks pretty frightening to me. In rolling out the idea of, for example, being a take away someone's passport just on suspicion that they might be a bit dodgy, and actually you have no idea why your passport's been taken away?
Yeah, I mean, completely. I mean, one of the first things I was actually briefed in as a counsellor was how to spot a terrorist. I mean, that might sound bizarre.
Okay, how do you?
And who briefed you?
It was the Prevent organisation. They were the people who came in and talked about it. But they were basically talking about things like if someone is just off on their own and things like that. But in terms of this, in terms of the actual... I suppose the ideology behind it is to say that nothing is private. You don't get a private life. You have to submit yourself in all these kinds of different ways to the state. And it's just not a way that we all imagine our state should work.
No, it sounds more like a police state.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, listen, a final story. I think it'll be our final story anyway. Drug and alcohol addicts and the obese to have their benefits slashed. Pledges David Cameron. Last weekend, UK Prime Minister David Cameron said people with drug and alcohol problems, people who are obese, would have their disability and sickness benefits removed if they refuse treatment. This is an election pledge, Rob.
I mean, I just... It's one thing after another with David Cameron. I mean, the idea that people who are addicted to drugs, have drug problems, and or obese should not be able to have a basic right as part of the society is a ridiculous suggestion, in my view. I don't know what to say except that.
Well, I mean, and then you say, well, what are they going to? Are they going to be executed, or are they just going to be starved, or are you going to find something more expensive to do than give them a benefit? Because that's what really you're talking about here.
It's time to wrap up now. Actually, time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. After the news, we'll be talking Bristol's about Direct BCFM Action, Earth First, and also talking to Steve Keane, the economist,
and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.